Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to Justice, with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In the series of Justice, we will explore the experiences of mothers in the justice system, from women who enter prison pregnant and give birth inside, to those who are separated from their children for imprisonment and involvement from social services. Each episode, I'll be speaking to expert guests and exploring what needs to change. In this episode, we explore pregnancy and birth in the justice system and what impact imprisoning pregnant women has on their safety and their babies. I spoke to Dr. Laura Abbott, a registered midwife and associate professor in research at the University of Hertfordshire, who has extensively researched women's experiences of pregnancy in criminal justice settings.
My name's Laura Abbott. My background is in midwifery. I'm a senior lecturer in midwifery at the University of Hertfordshire, and I'm also an associate professor in research. And my research background is looking specifically at pregnant women and new mothers in prison and their experiences of prison life.
Okay, and so you were a practicing midwife first. Is that what led you into the prison world, or how did you transition from midwifery in the community, if that's what it was?
That's a really good question. Well, I started off as a nurse, so I qualified in 93 as a nurse, and I worked in intensive care for a little while, and then after I had my first son, I decided that was the trigger for me to go into midwifery. So I trained as a midwife, and I worked as a midwife both in the NHS and also independently for several years before I went into teaching. So that's my background in midwifery. When I started teaching midwifery, I knew quite early on that I wanted to do some research, and I really wanted to do a doctorate. So I've always been really interested in working with those that are most marginalised, and what I really wanted to do is look at those women that might be really invisible to us, and that's what drew me to looking into what happens to pregnant women in prison.
Okay, and had you had women sort of come to you in hospital that were serving a prison sentence as such? So had you come across those women already?
Not really, actually. So I hadn't really. I'd worked with women who may have had more complex needs, complex issues, but I hadn't actually come across anyone who had been in prison. And I also had never been inside a prison. So you can imagine.
It was some weird draw.
I had this draw. But also, you know, when you think, you know, I was a midwife and I was a teacher, lecturing, I'd never been in a prison, so how on earth was I going to get in to do this research? So that was quite a journey in itself to actually get into prison.
Yeah, and actually it might be worth just spending a couple of minutes on that, because could you describe the process? Because lots of people want to do research in prisons, which on the whole is a really important thing that needs to be done, but it's very difficult. And of course, I do understand the challenges of the prison service, that if they have too many researchers all over the place, quite frankly, there aren't the staff to be able to be escorting them here, there and everywhere. So can you just explain a little bit of the process you have to go through?
I think in a way the process is rigorous for a reason. And like you say, the prisons are people's homes as well. And I think when we're thinking about the sensitive nature of what we're researching, it's really important to have a rigorous ethical process for going in. So it was in a way, although my journey into prison was quite complex, I think it was justifiably so. So the way that I started out is that I knew that I needed some experience of going into prison before I even started doing the research. So what I did is I contacted an amazing charity who I know you've heard of, Birth Companions.
Yeah.
And I trained to become a birth companion. What I did is I went through the same process as any volunteer would, and I still volunteer with Birth Companions, actually, because I strongly believe in their ethos. So I trained with them for 9 months, and so that was every Saturday, and with an amazing group of women, and it was... The training was lovely for me as a midwife, actually, because it was very much about supporting pregnant women, and it was... It was a revision, but I learned so many new skills. So even before stepping foot inside a prison, I did that 9 months training with them. And then I was able to become a volunteer. So I started volunteering inside of in one of the prisons that they go into, doing antenatal groups. So I'm quite experienced with doing antenatal education, but it's very, very different inside a prison.
Yeah, I was going to say, what were your sort of initial thoughts when you sort of went in, and how do they differ, the antenatal groups, compared to in the community?
I mean, women are the same everywhere. So when women are pregnant and they get together in a group, you're talking about your pregnancy, you're talking about the fact that you're feeling sick, you're talking about the fact that you're tired, and you're talking about the birth and your fears, and the same issues come up wherever you are. You get a group of pregnant women together. The fears for women in prison is completely different, though, because it's not just about those things that we all worry about when we're pregnant. There's so many other layers on top of that. So doing antenatal groups in prison, I mean, what I noticed first about the prison itself, prisons themselves they're quite brutal places. The atmosphere is tense. And I used to remember feeling and walking outside of a prison, it's almost like a breath of fresh air, sort of relief.
Yeah, your shoulders sort of come down, don't you?
They do. It's like this relief when you come out. And I was very conscious that I could walk out of there. I really felt strongly that it must be to hold that tension and to hold that stress, and knowing how you try when you're pregnant to be as relaxed as possible, because you know that stress can pass over and affect the baby, how it must feel for those women. So I would do the groups with, and it was always two or three of us birth companions that would do the groups.
Groups of how many women?
It really would depend, actually. Right. And it was always a choice. So women weren't made to come to these groups.
Yeah,
so
it wasn't part of their sentence,
not at all. It's always a choice. And I think what the women would say is it was a place just to feel normal for a little while. And to feel like a pregnant woman again. And that was quite nice within the groups, that women would just say, you know, it's just nice just to feel normal.
Yeah, I've been pregnant a few times, but of course on the outside. And actually what we all talk a lot about, don't we, is the extra things we need, as well as the what the hell is going on in my body and my mind.
Yeah.
And it's like the weird foods that you crave. So I knew I was pregnant because I needed tuna, and I don't really like tuna. And I knew I was pregnant because I went off coffee, and I love coffee. So there's those extra sort of things that you really crave and need, which you, of course, can to some extent get on the outside when you live in the community, that you are deprived of when you are on the inside. You can't just eat when you want. You can't have a bath. You can't. So could you sort of describe some of the particular challenges maybe that those women had in not being able to get their needs met?
I think there are so many challenges, and food is a massive, massive issue. It's huge. You know, it's so intrinsic to all of our lives, you know, what you eat. And when you have the choices taken away from you of what time you can eat, what you can eat, the quality of what you eat, and also the fact that you, like you say, when you're pregnant, you feel sick often. You might have heartburn. You are probably told by your midwife, well, if you're feeling a bit sick, just eat little and often. Have a cracker by the side of your bed.
Yeah, I remember I ate crackers like a mouse, like constantly, all day, every day, because I felt so sick.
Absolutely. But if you're...
You can't do that.
You can't do that. And if you are you know, if the prison's on lockdown and you are locked in a cell for 23 hours and you're feeling sick and feeling uncomfortable. And when I did my research, actually, so I'm sort of skipping about a bit, but, you know, when I started doing my research and the prisons, it was still smoking in prisons then. So women would be sharing a cell often with women who smoke, and or they may be on a smoking wing. And that as well, when women would say, I feel so sick. Some women even started smoking when they were pregnant to relieve some of the stress, and they thought, well, I may as well anyway, even if they didn't. But that was something that was quite striking, that the women would, because I would go and visit women in their rooms, in their cells, and the wings would be really, really smoky. And it's like, you know, there was like no choice about that. I mean, we don't have smoking in prisons now, but still it just really struck me, sort of the environment. And the good thing about the research that I did, it was an ethnographic research, which basically means that, you know, I sort of hung around prisons to really understand the environment. I thought, I cannot possibly understand what it's like to be pregnant in prison if I don't spend some time, days and days, being, you know, we're in the same spaces that these women are.
And sort of all the time.
All the time.
What sort of time would you go in and leave? And
I'd go in quite early. I mean, it was really, again, all of that process was really interesting, because I remember there was one particular time that I'd booked some field work. I'd booked quite a long time of field work, and there'd been an incident in one of the prisons and I wasn't allowed in. And it was so, and you know, and I had to organise my kids, and I'd had to, you know, it was only sort of, I mean, it's sort of not massive issues, but that was really stressful. You know, never knowing when I'd be allowed in was quite a strange, and I always had that sort of fear. And what I also did with my research is I wanted to be as close to the women's experience as possible. I couldn't possibly be, you know, in their shoes, but I chose not to have keys. So because I didn't have keys, I had to go through sort of security processes all the time. And, you know, even things like, if you want to go to the loo, you have to ask someone to take you. You have to constantly rely on somebody to shepherd you around the prison. But also I felt very much you know, like kind of a little bit trapped, because I couldn't leave unless I asked someone to take me out. So it's not, I mean, it's obviously not the same experience that they're going through, but I could really feel that. And I think that helped with the authenticity of my research, because it meant that I didn't have that barrier. And what really cemented that for me is when in one of the prisons I did the birth companions work, I was able to wear keys. And one of the women I'd met before I was able to wear keys said to me, oh, are you staff now? And I thought, I'm really pleased that I didn't have keys.
Right, because they equate the keys to a staff member, yes, which absolutely might have got in the way of the sort of authenticity of your research.
Yeah, and there's something about having that belt on and the keys that does, I don't know, I felt that actually does do something to you in a way that makes you feel a little bit more part of the prison rather than part of...
Absolutely. Well, it's the all-powerful keys, right, yes, isn't it? It's the difference of getting in and getting out, and the freedom of movement, which I think is such a
fear that you're going to take them home with you.
Yeah, which would be land you in all sorts of trouble.
Yes, absolutely.
So the pregnant women, would they be on the general wing in the main part of the prison? And then maybe could you explain at what point, if they were to be moved onto a mother and baby unit? We have 12 women's prisons, don't we? And we have six mother and baby units.
Yes. Yeah.
And that can be quite a difficult process, can't it, getting a place on them?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a really good question, because the inconsistency, you know, even within the same prisons was quite striking too. So it's with regards to getting a place, it's very complex. And again, you know, all the checks and balances need to be gone through really carefully. But we find that often the places are quite underutilized, and we don't know the numbers exactly of how many mothers and babies are separated. And also we are not quite sure, you know, how many stay with their, you know, we don't keep those numbers yet.
When you say we don't keep them, do we mean the Ministry of Justice doesn't gather them?
Yeah, I don't know why I say we, actually.
Yeah, we're all in this weird world together, aren't we?
Yeah.
And that's, we'll come back to that because I've discussed this a lot with other guests on this podcast in this particular series, because there aren't that many pregnant women in the system, because we don't actually have that many women in the system. Yeah. So it actually wouldn't be the most difficult thing in the whole wide world to gather data on, right?
Absolutely not.
And it's just sort of one of my real bugbears of like, you know, why is someone in the 8 floors of the Ministry of Justice, why is that data not being gathered? Because how can you write policy and make policy about these things if you don't have the data to write the policy from?
Well, I've been told exactly why it can't be gathered.
Okay. Why?
Which was the most strange reason. So I was told when I was, I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Edward Argar at the time. And he told me that they couldn't keep the data because of confidentiality. And it made me think, actually, you know, confidentiality, one, we're keeping data. Data doesn't have, you know, names. It does not, it's just numbers.
Confidentiality from who?
I don't know. I
mean, I'd understand if it was sort of MI5 and MI6, but this is data.
Yeah.
This is actually health data.
Absolutely. And we need to know the outcomes for these babies. We know the outcomes for all the babies in this country. We have massive databases of you know, it's all, everything's confidential. I mean,
And this is about the safety and the health of the child as well as the mother. You know, this is separate to the sentence that they're serving for the crime that they may or may not have committed.
Absolutely.
Extraordinary.
And that was the reason that I was given, because that's something that struck me quite early on, that why on earth do we not know?
I think he didn't know why we don't know, so had to come up with something. It would be my interpretation of it.
Yeah, it was an interesting, I just thought that's really interesting, because we keep numbers on, I mean, there's nothing you can't do. We keep numbers on everything. But also the confidentiality, I mean, where do you draw the line then? Because, you know, someone's got diabetes in prison, you know, we've got all sorts of data on
that. So as it stands today, in where are we, March 2023, we don't have the data of how many pregnant women are in prison.
I don't know. I think
so. If we do, it's not easily accessible.
It's not easily accessible. But I think we could find out now. I think that's something that has changed from the new policies that are coming out, that we do need to know. And I think that's been a long time coming. But you know, we absolutely do need to know. I mean, the community midwives need to know, and the midwives in that are caring for these women need to know as well. So it's not. Yeah, it just seems really strange.
One of those strange grey areas. Yeah. Yeah. So you do the antenatal groups, and would they take place in the general population, in the main part of the prison, or would they take place in the mother and baby units?
Main part of the prison.
Okay.
Yeah. So with birth companions, they it depends on the prison, actually, because often it changes where you do them. So I think, you know, in some of them I've done, they may be in a visitor centre, or they might be in a room somewhere. But we also go and visit the mother and baby units as well, and do groups with mothers with their babies as well.
Okay.
So that's quite a nice thing.
And I guess it depends on what stage of pregnancy the woman's at. So if she's just found out she's pregnant, that would be different, I assume, if someone was 8 months pregnant and sentenced to prison.
Yeah.
What would happen in that situation?
They'd still be in the same group. So the group.
So they'd still go on to general population.
Still be on general population. Usually. It's quite, I mean, again, when I first started my research, there was an assumption that all pregnant women went into mother and baby units, which is not
to wait to have their baby.
Yeah,
but that's not the case. So what happens is they're heavily pregnant on the general wing.
On the general wing.
Of the normal prison.
Of a normal prison. Yeah.
And then?
And then they usually, it really varies from woman to woman. So what I've, from my research, what I noticed that some women didn't know that they had a mother and baby unit place until some of them.
Oh, okay. They'd know that there was a mother and baby unit there. Yes. But they wouldn't know whether they'd been successful in acquiring a place.
They wouldn't know. Or some women would be in prisons without mother and baby units, pregnant. So they'd be sort of not quite knowing whether or not they were going to get a place.
And if they did, they'd be transferred from one prison to another.
They would, but usually after the birth. Okay. So it didn't usually happen that they would go onto a mother and baby unit whilst they were pregnant. That was during my research. I think some women will go on when they're pregnant, but because the process is quite difficult, it often takes place quite late on in pregnancy. And I think this is something that really is, I mean, I know there's the Trowler Review has very much looked at mother and baby unit places and in prison and what the system that's going on, and they're talking very much about changing that process to make it shorter, so that women know. And the project that I'm doing at the moment, the Lost Mothers Project that I've started, that's going to be looking at those processes as well, but it's more looking at the experiences. So it's very much an individual thing. I found that some women didn't know until they'd actually given birth and they were in hospital, and then they'd been told whether or not they'd get a place. I've met women who may have come in a few weeks after having given birth in the community, coming in to serve their sentence, having to leave their baby outside and then apply once they're actually inside the prison to try and get their baby. And that's been very complex and difficult for some women.
Right. So if a woman had given birth in hospital to their baby and they had got a place on the mother and baby unit, the mother and baby would go together to the mother and baby unit. Mm-hmm. If they hadn't been successful, what happens at the hospital?
What happens at the hospital, it depends very much on who is going to be looking after the baby. If the baby's going straight into foster care, that baby will be taken by social services.
So a social service worker turns up and literally walks out with the baby.
We'll take the baby. And that is something, again, thinking about separation from mothers and their newborn babies. There's always going to be situations where a mother and baby can't stay together.
But that's an important point, isn't it? Because in some cases it is appropriate that the child is taken away for its own safety.
Yes.
For reasons of the mother's behaviour or the sentence, right? But in many cases it will just be, well, no, the mother poses no risk to her baby, but there's just not a place, or she hasn't been successful in getting a place.
It's more about the success. There's usually a place because they're underutilised. It's more about the success. There is an appeals process, but again, that's really complex, really difficult. So it's more about whether or not she's successful in getting a place. And what we're finding is that, you know, quite often women are separated and we don't quite know why. So we don't know quite what's actually happened in that situation for her to be separated, because if she was in the community, she would be looking after her babies or her children. I think part of it, and this is again the research that the Lost Mothers research that we're doing, and that's going to be, you know, in conjunction with birth companions, their lived experience team. We want to look at and think, well, you know, what is going on? Why are these decisions being made? Is the training not enough? Do we have all the health professionals knowing that prison mother and baby units are actually really, you know, very, you know, Ofsted inspected safe places with, you know, with nursery staff, with specially trained officers there? It's a prison within the prison. It's not the same as, you know, you're just putting a mother and a baby in a cell. And I think there's a misconception sometimes amongst those that might be making the decisions about prison. And also making an assumption about that woman. And it really has to be an individual, you know, and I know they all work very hard to make these decisions, but sometimes, you know, I've heard officers say to me, but she'd be a really good mum. And, you know, it is, that decision is, it stays with you forever and ever, you and your baby, your child, and it can have devastating consequences. And
absolutely, for both the baby and the mother, and sort of the multi-generational trauma. But it's a bit like someone walking off with your leg. I mean, you know, it's kind of like we grow these little babies in our body. So until the umbilical cord is cut, they are us.
Yeah.
They are part of our body, literally, aren't they? And everything, our mind, our body, our emotions is all. So the idea that you'd then see this little thing disappearing out the door when actually you know that you pose no risk to that child. And of course, the naysayers, there's always a group of people will say, well, she should have thought about that before she committed the crime. But of course, what people forget is not everybody's in for a violent crime, and 80% of women in our prison system are in for non-violent crimes, and they're low risk.
Yeah.
So they might be in for a driving offence, or their child might have played truant. They might not have paid their TV licence. They might not have paid their council tax.
Absolutely.
You know, there's all sorts of reasons why people end up in prison. And of course, some women are in prison because they've been coerced into a crime by a violent male. Yeah. So it's not quite as clean cut as saying, oh, well, it's Rosemary West, therefore she shouldn't have a child with her. Okay, I think we could all understand that.
Yeah.
But it's not always the case that it's that extreme.
Yeah. And I think that's a really, you know, important point, that the majority of the women that I spoke to in my research were in, like you say, the focus was on their experience rather than on their crime. But the majority of those women were in for non-violent crimes, as you say. I just think about, I mean, I can picture every single woman that I spoke to 28 women as part of my research. I can picture every single one of them, every single story, experience really stayed with me. And I do think from what you're just saying there, one particular woman, she was, you know, very young, very early 20s, first offence. Again, as you say, it was one of those offences where she may have been coerced by a male in her life. And she was in prison with her, pregnant with her second child. And she had a younger baby on the outside, actually. She didn't know that she could have brought the baby into prison with her. She wasn't told. She was in a prison without a mother and baby unit. She didn't know whether or not she was going to get a place in a mother and baby unit. Quite a vulnerable young woman. And it really stayed with me, the fact that this was somebody who didn't find out till really late on whether she was going to get a place in a mother and baby unit. There was nothing wrong with her as a mum at all. That her baby was in the community, had been with her. There was no reason why, you know, she wouldn't be able to look after this baby just as well. But she didn't know. And she was in one prison, and she was moved out of that prison when she went to give birth, and then moved into another prison miles and miles and miles away. And it just really made me think about, you know, you build it, even when you're in prison, you build up a community of support amongst the other women that might be on your wing, you know, your pad mate, your staff. And then to go out of that prison, to go into hospital, to give birth, and then to be moved, you know, 2 hours drive away from that, you know, that support network, and from your family as well, with a newborn, with all those issues being, you know, driven, sort of flanked with prison officers. And it just made me think as well, you know, what's all this for? I mean, her sentence was probably about 8 months, but that in that 8 months, I mean, look at the damage.
And it was that 8 months that she had to serve, or was that 8 months, in which case she would serve 4 months?
I think, I can't remember with her. Yeah.
But either way, it's such a sort of small amount, you know, it sort of proves that she posed no risk to the community. So she really should have had a community sentence.
Yeah. We all have a perception of prison before going into prison, and it's the same with the women as well. So if you go in when you're pregnant, you've got this perception that it's going to be a really, really, really dangerous place, and I'm going to get hurt, and someone's going to knife me in my sleep. And they have this perception, and I think that's quite often, especially for the first time. And I remember speaking to women who would literally want to hide the fact that they were pregnant because they were so terrified that somebody would come and hurt them. You know, and that fear was really, really real and really palpable. And, you know, women would, I remember one woman saying that, you know, I just wear really baggy tops so no one can see I'm pregnant. And, you know, it's kind of almost like the opposite of the majority of pregnant women.
Yeah,
maybe.
And wanting to talk about it. And
who do you share that experience with? And that was, and I was so fortunate, because when women came to talk to me, they were so candid about what they about their experiences. But that was something that I hadn't thought about before, that sort of feeling scared and feeling really stressed. The stress was huge. And really, one of the biggest stresses was the thought of giving birth in a prison cell. And that was something that all the women were scared about.
Well, I can imagine, because I was going to go back to that, actually. Mm. So you might be sharing a cell with someone. I presume you'd be on a bottom bunk if you were heavily pregnant, for the obvious reasons of not being able to get up to the top one heavily pregnant. But A, the uncomfortableness of knowing that when you're heavily pregnant, you have to lie in all sorts of strange ways to try and take the weight of the baby in your tummy. But then thinking, oh, my God, you know, if you started getting contractions, or if your waters broke, And then what? You have to wait. You don't know how quickly that baby's going to arrive. It could be 48 hours or it could happen in the next 30 minutes. Well, are you going to get out of the prison in time?
Yeah.
Are you going to be in the sweatbox?
Yeah.
Or do they get moved in a different type of transport? Or do they get put in the traditional prison vans?
It's the inconsistency has been across the estate. And I know they're trying to, I know there's really goodwill right from the top trying to change that now. Within my research, I spoke to a woman who'd given birth in her cell, and she had her situation was just horrendous.
Was she sharing a cell or was she by herself?
She was on her own. This is a woman, she knew I was doing my research and she actually sought me out to come and tell me what her situation was and what her story was. And she had, she was around 8 months pregnant, she was 36 weeks pregnant. And she had told, she'd felt that something was happening. She'd had a baby before, so this was her second baby. And she was having pains because she was having contractions, she felt. And she told the staff and they didn't believe her. And she called for help and they didn't believe her. And she ended up, getting to a stage where it was too late. Her baby was lying breech. So that means it's bottom first, which is, she's premature with a breech baby and no one has believed that this woman is in labour. And she ended up birthing in her prison cell, this baby coming sort of bum and feet first, and with no one trained to help her, to support her, without thinking about the absolute sort of terror and the fact that this is totally unsafe, the fact she wasn't believed, the dignity of it, the danger of that baby not needing resuscitation. Now, I know as a midwife, there's a load of red flags for me. One, she's 36 weeks. I mean, if I was her midwife,
you wouldn't be very far away.
No.
Because we all know that, a baby can come at any time,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Because things go wrong. It's just horrific. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing to think about is totally horrific.
And also, she didn't know whether she had a mother and baby unit place. So she ended up being transferred to hospital with her baby, and that's when she found out that she was going to be put in a mother and baby unit with her baby, but she didn't know. She had no clothes for the baby. She had, not even the little hats.
So she gave birth in the cell.
In the cell.
And then at what point did an officer come in and now I believe you.
Yeah.
Because there's a baby on the floor.
Well, I think, she didn't give birth actually on, she had an officer and I think she had a nurse that had come down.
Right, so then they're like, we believe you because it's happening.
Yes, and it was too late because they could see that the baby was coming.
Okay.
But she didn't have a midwife with her. And, we midwives and doctors, we are the qualified people to be able to tell if someone, to be able to assess someone and say yes or no, you're in labour. And also, it's not for anyone to disbelieve somebody.
Well, I was going to say, it's such an extraordinary thing to be like, I don't believe you. You're not talking to a child who might have nicked some sweets and you found the wrappers under their bed or something.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, I know.
What do you mean you don't believe me? It's like, absolutely. Why would you make up the fact when you're heavily pregnant that you think you might be in labour? I mean,
it's just
extraordinary. But also, to be fair to the staff then that are there, it's really traumatic, I imagine,
really
having
traumatic.
To walk into a situation where you know you're untrained. I mean, I'm obviously not trained as a midwife. If I was anywhere near someone giving birth, I'd find that really traumatic. I'd do my best. I wouldn't have a clue what to do. And if it went wrong, that would live with me for the rest of my life.
So
it really
staff,
is an extraordinary situation to allow to happen.
It's a really, that's absolutely right. And it's really unfair to put that on staff, I think. And it's, I spoke to quite a number of staff in my research and they would talk to me about their fears. And there was no training. I mean, I've been doing some training with prison officers, and I know the midwives that are in prison do some training with prison officers as well. But it's not part of their remit, really. Should not be their responsibility. It's really unfair to put them in that position. And also, nurses are not trained midwives. They're not, you know, it's only a registered midwife that's got professional entry into the register to be able to assess and deliver babies. I mean, it's a legal responsibility. It's not something that, you know, you can misrepresent. You have to be legally trained. I mean, I, you know, worked as a nurse for years, but I'd also done my 18-month training. I had to qualify, I had to deliver 40 babies and, you know, do 100 antenatal checks, yeah, plus all the, you know, degree and everything else that I had to do to become a competent midwife, and also the emergencies. So I know,
yeah, I was thinking about the amount of things that can go wrong. And I've obviously had lots of friends who've gone through all sorts of different things, and whether it's the umbilical cord around the neck or their breech or, you know, you tear, there's, you know, colossal blood loss. Yeah. I mean, it's just like the list goes on.
And it's like you don't know what you don't know. And I think, you know, from me, when she told me her story, there were so many like red flags, and it was this massive alarm system going off in my head. I was thinking, oh, she's premature, so the baby's going to lose heat. It's going to need, you're going to need to have a warm room without drafts. It's going to have
to. And a sterile environment, which a prison cell is not.
No. And also, you know, just things like, I also know if a baby's born by breech, you're more likely to have a postpartum hemorrhage. It's just one of those things. And to manage a postpartum hemorrhage in a prison where you don't know even the first thing to do, because it's, you know, as midwives, you're trained, you need to stimulate the uterus, so you need you need to be able to do that, and you need to give the drugs, and there's all sorts of things you need to do. So my head was spinning. I was thinking, how on earth could anyone not?
I mean, it's so primitive. When you sort of are talking about it out loud, I mean, even though you've known this for years, I have too. I wrote a dissertation on mother and baby, and it's sort of 20 years ago, and it doesn't seem that things have got much better. I'm sure they have got a bit better. But even when you know about it, when you're talking about it out loud, it sounds like something that would happen in the early 18th century.
Yeah, and it's
just extraordinary.
And it's just, it's so unfair on the women.
Yeah, and it's unnecessary, is the other thing, isn't it? It's actually just unnecessary. Yeah. There's lots of things in the system that we can't change, but there's quite a lot, and that's why I get really animated, as you can tell, because there's quite a lot we can change.
Yeah.
And some things that fundamentally should just be done.
Yeah.
And this obviously being one of them. But my further question on this lady who then she gave birth in her cell. And then does she and the baby then get taken to hospital for checks, and maybe if she needs sort of stitches and a health check?
Yeah.
So
she's taken to hospital. And I think you asked before, how do women get transferred into hospital? So, you know, when somebody's in labour, it really depends where she is. If she's in an open prison, it may be that she's going in a taxi with a prison officer, or it may be that she's transferred in an ambulance. It depends very much.
Okay. And there's always a question around the handcuffs. What was your experience of that? Because there's always a very heated debate.
It's always a heated debate, isn't it? Because it's very...
Whether it happens or not.
I know.
And it's like, well,
I know. It depends.
Sure, it's easily answered.
It often depends who you ask as well, doesn't it?
Right.
But I think with handcuffs in labour, it's a no-no. But then occasionally women will tell you that they are cuffed in labour. You're also not supposed to. And in our new policy, which is our
You're very invested in the topic.
You know what I mean, don't
you?
So the new policy, it says that you shouldn't. In fact, the policy's always been that there shouldn't be handcuffed.
But what we know about prisons, you and I both, is that there's lots of well-meaning policies, but whether people adhere to them or not is a very different thing.
Very much. And I think, again, it's not necessarily the staff's fault, because I don't think it's very clear. And you know, if your job is as a prison officer and to guard your prisoners, I can understand why you would be a bit nervous, but it needs to be much more clarity. So pregnant women should not be handcuffed when they go to antenatal appointments.
But did some women that you spoke to say that had categorically happened?
Absolutely.
Okay. Right.
I would say that nearly all of the women that I spoke to had experience of going to anti, even if they'd gone and their cuffs had been taken off outside the hospital before the antenatal clinic. But also going in with the prison officers. And I think The one huge issue with my research and the women that I found was shame, was massive. So again, we're talking about women, the majority have got, you know, non-violent crimes, and they're going into antenatal clinics, which are filled with
handcuffs on, so yeah, cuffed to their own wrists, yeah, or cuffed to an officer.
Cuffed to the, or they had the long chains on. Right. So they'd have the, either that or the long chains. So it was really... women would talk about how totally humiliated they were. And remembering that pregnant women are going to be going in and out of prison more often than any other prisoner, because they're going for maybe consultant appointments, they may be going for scans. They're often more high risk anyway, because they may have, you know, lifestyles that might make them sort of have more medical problems anyway. So they're going to be going in and out of hospital to prison, backwards and forwards. They don't know when they're going because they're not told. And they feel that shame. And that women would say, you know, everyone's looking at me, and it, oh, I've got all the mums and dads, and I feel so ashamed and humiliated. It's so embarrassing. People are looking at me like I'm a serial killer. And, you know, that was the thing that came across a lot from all the women I spoke to, actually, was that feeling of shame and embarrassment and humiliation and feeling judged. And it felt really unfair. And that added another layer of stress for women. So, I mean, again, that's sort of, it's another thing where control is completely taken away. So most of us are, you know, if we're going to hospital to have a scan, you might be nervous, you might be excited, but you would know when. You might be able to take someone with you. You might be able to talk about it with, you know, your friends, or you might be able to share your fears. When you're in prison, you don't know when you're going for that scan. So you get a knock on the cell door. Right, we're going for a scan. So you haven't had a time. And I don't know about you, but whenever I've gone, you know, when you go to hospital visits or go to see your midwife, or, you know, you might shave your legs, or you might, you know, you might
get yourself
not
prepared.
Yeah, you want to be
poking around on your body.
Yes. Yeah. You know, it's those sorts of things that just strip away a little bit more of that control for her and for her experience. And all of those things were a really big deal. Just not knowing when. And again, you know, there's two sides. And if we were to speak to the prison service, of course, you can't tell everybody when they're going to be going out. But I think it's something that I hadn't thought about before.
Yeah. So. And also, of course, when you go out for a scan, sometimes at scans, you're told some particularly distressing news, and you can find out that your baby is unwell or might not survive the pregnancy. And I guess that's another issue if people don't have the support with them.
Yeah.
Other than a prison officer who might not know what to say.
Absolutely.
Sort of sensitive topic. Did you come across anyone who then might have had to have a termination or decided they wanted a termination? Does that sort of come into it much, or is that sort of not really talked about?
I mean, it's a really good question, but I mean, with my research, it was focused on women that wanted to continue with their pregnancy. But right. You're absolutely right to bring that up, because it is a massive issue. You know, again, it's not something that I've researched, so it's not my area of expertise, but it's a really important area of reproductive justice for women. And
especially when you sort of think about the women who are raped.
Yeah.
And understandably might not want to go forward with that pregnancy. And if they've been raped by a family member and have become pregnant, I mean, it's really horrendous sort of topic, isn't it? But
but they're all things that we've come across, and it's all things that, you know, again, with terminations, it's so personal and it's so private. And of course, you know, if you're in prison, you have to have somebody escort you to have that termination. And, you know, it's not just thinking about the woman, you're thinking about the staff and how difficult that must be for the staff to manage. You know, you might have a woman prison officer who might be struggling to conceive herself, or
there may be, or might also have had a miscarriage. Absolutely. And might not agree with the fact that someone's having a termination. I mean, it is
a complete minefield, and I think it's a really important area. And, you know, when we're thinking about women's imprisonment, it's something we need to think about as well, you know, from that choice element, and also the timing, because, you know, I think, you know, women that might be in early pregnancy or may find out early may want to have a termination you know, as soon as possible earlier in their pregnancy. But when your timetable is sort of dictated by the prison system, it's things are very slow. You know, with prison, the wheels turn so much slower than, you know, on the outside. So it's very difficult. And how disempowering it is for her to not be able to, you know, make that decision with the health professionals in the timely way that she might want to.
Yeah. There were two high-profile cases of two babies that sadly died, wasn't there, in two particular prisons that hit the media and was covered by the papers in HMP Bronzefield and HMP Stile. And, of course, the one in Bronzefield, the young care leaver that she was on remand, wasn't she?
Yeah.
And she went into labour, as you discussed, like the lady you're talking about, and no one came, and she had the baby, didn't she? And the baby died. And she was then found in her bed with her dead baby, having wrapped it up in blankets. So since then, I believe that there has been quite a bit of attention that has gone towards how we organise ourselves inside prisons. Can you talk a bit about what's sort of come out of that?
Yeah, and I mean, what...
Oh, and by the way, I just need to add
that
young care leaver who went through that was then found not guilty.
Yes.
And so she left prison. So that whole situation was completely avoidable.
Absolutely.
Had she not been remanded.
18. She was 18 years old.
Yeah.
To go through that. I mean, even now talking about it gives me goosebumps.
Oh, me too. Just and awful. For the trauma of the prison officer who eventually came in to find this scene.
I mean, it's just...
doesn't bear thinking
about. Yeah, it's horrific for
And actually, you know, then my mind goes to the responsibility as an employer of those staff.
Yeah.
How is it possible
that
happens? I have no words for it.
I mean, it is just staggering. I mean, those two, I mean, I remember vividly when I heard about those cases. And I know it sounds really strange, but I felt really guilty. And it's because I'd alerted the prison system when I did my research. So I did my research back in, you know, I did my fieldwork 2015, 2016. And I had alerted the prison service about my findings. I'd spoken to the Care Quality Commission about my findings, the health inspector about my findings. So I felt, you know, that I really needed to get something done. And I think I said to you earlier about needing to finish my doctorate really, you know, within a really sharp time frame, even though, you know, it was just going on.
Yeah, it would have been a long time.
I really needed to finish it. I involved the media. So I spoke on various radio programs. I spoke, you know, again, not on my own, but I did it with birth companions. We spoke, you know, we had articles in The Guardian about women birthing in cells and how something had to be done. An amazing politician who you know, I think Carolyn Harris, raised this in parliamentary questions and, you know, we talked, and she actually said we need mandatory standards. So that was in sort of 2017, 2018. I gave evidence at Joint Human Rights Committee. Dame Doreen Lawrence asked me questions about births in cells. I told the Joint Human Rights Committee about the dangers and how, you know, how worried we were. And it, again, not just on my own, this is the whole group of us saying how terribly worried we were that something, a tragedy was going to occur. So when I heard about those deaths, I just felt awful. I thought, I haven't done enough. I genuinely thought I haven't done enough. And I really, and it had always been my worry, and it kind of, because it came true, I just felt horrified about that. But yeah, the changes, it has driven through the changes quite rightly. It should have, in my opinion, the changes should have come before. And, you know, we don't know, who knows whether we'd have been able to prevent these awful, awful tragedies for these two, you know, poor young women that it just should never, ever have happened. But it's the changes are good in terms of we've now got the statutory policy. And I've been
adhered to? Because this comes back to my policies are great and they look great on a piece of paper. And it's really great listening to people talk about policies when you're in a prison. How much faith do you have just slightly playing devil's advocate?
No, that's
that
a really
they're being
good
adhered to.
Well, there's some positives in the fact that the Ministry of Justice and the women's team are very engaged with people like myself. So I meet with them on a regular basis and basically hold them to account. They hold, you know, they want to be held to account.
Yeah.
There's some really goodwill there. They don't want these tragedies to happen. So it's good that now we are working together, because I think before we weren't.
Yeah.
So it's, again, it's not just me. It's all, you know, really important people in charge of healthcare around the country all come together to talk, and social care talk about, and I have set up with prison midwives in this country. We've got the Prison Midwives Action Group, so we meet on a regular basis online, and that's a supportive group where we, you know, come together, and because it's a hard job out there doing this, all the things that we're talking about, so they're a great group of midwives, and they will tell me what's going on the ground, so I'm able to feed back to the women's team about things, saying, hang on a minute, this isn't happening, that's not happening. So that's, in that way, they are very willing to hear what's not going right. So the policy is, as you said, it's beautifully written. It's a really good policy. But I mean, I don't think, I can't speak for everything. I mean, I think there's goodwill there trying to, but, you know, it's not, it can't possibly be. While we're still locking up pregnant women, they're so individual. I don't think we can possibly apply all of this policy to every pregnant woman across the state.
The policy is probably quite long, but could you give me the sort of headlines of what the recommendations were and what they say now must happen?
One of the key things is that we now have their PMBLOs, which I can never remember what it stands for. So that's Prison Mother and Baby Unit Liaison Officers.
Okay,
I think.
Well done.
Liaison
Officers.
Liaison Officers.
Right.
So these are officers who have a special interest and have some training in caring for pregnant women and new mothers. And I think the main thing is that this is their motivation. They're supportive officers that want to work together with the pregnant women. So that's quite nice in the sense that that's a new layer of support for the pregnant women. However, they are not midwives, and it's great that we have them, but
it
doesn't go far enough. In my eyes, it doesn't go far enough at all. I think I just probably be as bold to say that I think we should really, really rethink whether we even send pregnant women to prison at all.
Well, exactly, because, you know, people will often say, well, it's too expensive to maybe have a midwife if you might have a whole prison of women and none of them are pregnant, right? So I guess it's difficult to sort of work out the staffing on that. So therefore, there's another option, isn't there, which is to say they can serve their time in another way, unless it's a particularly risky, violent person who might need to go to prison, absolutely, in which case they'd probably have their child removed off them anyway.
Yeah. Even the most vulnerable situation, even the most heinous crime that we can think of, if we still need to provide care for her. So I do think the majority of pregnant women probably shouldn't be in prison, or like you say, there's other countries do it. You know, there's many countries around the world that don't lock up their pregnant women, mainly for these sorts of reasons. So I think when you see the stress on the staff as well, and now more than ever, there's a lot of stress and strain because they know the eventuality of what can happen. So when I've done training with prison officers, so I've been doing that a little bit with Unlocked Grads.
Right.
I don't know if you might have heard from them. That's another great organisation. So,
absolutely.
So doing training with the prison officers, and it has been like when I've talked to them about obviously I'm doing some sort of training in, you know, what to do if a baby is born in a cell and it's not breathing, what do you do? So we go through these scenarios, what do you do? And it is and just training the very basics, like you need to make sure that the umbilical cord stays attached to the mother. You're not going to go cutting that at all. You need to make sure the baby's warm and dry, because babies that lose heat, they stop breathing. And I teach them about doing just a little bit of breathing for that baby. And also I teach them about the very first line of, you know, if someone has a postpartum hemorrhage, what to do, you know. And again,
what's the reaction out of interest? Because even just listening to it, I used to think, oh my God, that's such that a responsibility reaction. Because prison officers, you know, get trained for, what is it, 6 to 8 weeks, and you now get a little bit of difference in training depending on whether you're going to a male prison or a female prison, and you often don't know whether you're going to end up working with men or women. It's like sort of apples and pears for these exact reasons that we're talking about. So what's the sort of reaction from officers?
The reaction is, we're going to get them out. We're going to get them out with, you know, the slightest twinge. But I think what it does is it really cements their responsibilities, where their responsibilities lie. So what it does, it says, because what I found speaking to women is that they're often not believed. So when they say, I'm really worried that my baby's not moving, it's like, oh, you know, she just wants to trip out. You know, you do hear that, and that sounds quite cynical, but that's the reality.
Yeah.
You know, oh, well, she's having a few twinges, but she's not in labour. It's not, you're better safe than sorry. And I think what comes out of this is that to listen to women and to believe
her. Well, exactly. And if you have someone who's unqualified, you know, how can they say, oh, it's just Braxton Hicks contractions, or it's nothing? Yeah. They're not qualified to make that judgment.
No. Absolutely not. And it's a breach of a very sort of serious rule that is in statute, which is I think it's Nursing Midwifery Council 2001 that says nobody can make these decisions, and it's in law. You know, so you've got prison officers. I mean, then I don't think anyone's meaning to do it, but you might have nursing staff and prison officers who say, oh, no, you're not in labour, or that it's actually a breach of the law, because you're not supposed to be making those decisions at all.
This comes back to the accountability, doesn't it? And who, you know, with this new policy, who is it? If you don't have anyone who's in that prison checking the whole time that these policies are adhered to, they're nothing, are they?
Yeah, and I suppose it's the governing governor that ultimately has that responsibility.
Yeah.
But I think, again, it's just, it comes back to the situation that, you know, it's unpredictable. I mean, there's one thing that you do know with pregnancy. It is going to continue until it's not continuing forever. It's going to end at some stage with her going into labour. So we have to be prepared for that.
Yeah.
We know.
And it's an inevitability, one way or another.
Yeah, I was so shocked when I did my research. It was almost like, there's no planning.
Yeah,
there's no planning.
And it is unbelievable, isn't it? You just like, I cannot. We are in 2023. Yeah. There's people talking about artificial intelligence, and you know, and then you sort of hear and see these things, and it really hurts my brain sometimes because I'm like, this isn't possible.
Well, I would be in the prison thinking, what is going on? You know, I also thought when I was doing my research, no one is ever going to believe this, because it's just like, it sounds so far-fetched. And again, in some of the prisons now, we have specialist midwives who have protected time for their midwifery duties, and they're specific, specialised prison midwives, but that's not in all prisons. There's some prisons that will, you know, you've still got midwives who are out in the community, and it's part of their community caseload to go into the prison.
Okay, so they just go into the prison every now and again.
Yeah, and their response, they have that as part of their caseload, and we have to. If we've got pregnant women in this country in our prisons, we have to have specialist midwives in our prisons. And I cannot for the life of me think why we don't have that in all of our prisons yet. I think that is a bit of a travesty, actually.
Because that's the thing, you know, people talk about sort of the cost of things and resources. Yeah. And it's like, again, to get it into perspective, there's 12 women's prisons.
Yeah, I know, it's not.
In the grand scheme of things, when you think of HS2 and you think of the cost of Brexit and the cost of going to war and all these things that are realities that are happening in our country. It's like 12, just 12 midwives. I mean, for Christ's sake.
Yeah. It's not.
You know, it's not a big ask, is it?
I know exactly, and then, you know, you get brilliant work out of those 12 midwives as
yes.
well. You know, you really. I mean, the midwives that I know that are working in our prisons are just amazing, and they are working with some of the most complex, you know, challenging situations, and you know, they're often a little bit. Outside of this, that's why we've got this support, because they're often outside of any other sort of support. It's really like we're talking about, you know, no one will believe us. This is so, such a far-fetched world. So the midwives that are working in prison, that it's outside of most people's experience and remit as well, that they don't yeah. see this. And it's another thing that I've been sort of going on about is like on the health inspectorate that goes into prisons. Now, how on earth can we hold the prisons to account if we don't have a midwife on that health inspectorate? You know, I've been saying this for years, and I don't understand why we don't have somebody who, you know, not just a midwife, but a midwife that understands prisons on our health inspectorate, who can really go and see that actually, yeah, these changes are happening on the ground, and hold the prison system to account. And that's something I think is really important that needs to be brought
up. Yeah. Do you think it's a hangover from the fact that the prison service still is in many ways very much a sort of a man's world, and it's a masculine system, and obviously women are shoehorned in, which is why I think we've got now a bit of a legacy of these things not being looked at, talked about. Mm. You know, it's changing a bit now. It's the work that you're doing and the research you're allowed to do. And that's all great. But I sort of sometimes wonder if this was an issue that affected men, that maybe it would have changed quicker. I don't know. What do you feel about that?
I think it would have done. When I first started doing the research, the word midwife didn't appear anywhere in anything. There was no, we were invisible as the women, really. And I thought that was really odd. It was almost like, you know, again, I've been a nurse, I've trained as a nurse and then trained as a midwife. It's a very different job. It's like saying a physio is the same as a paramedic. It's not. We're a quite distinct profession that have distinct responsibilities. And I was staggered that we weren't mentioned anywhere, especially when we are, you know, in this country, that we provide care for all pregnant women in this country. So I didn't get that. I didn't understand. I mean, it's there everywhere now. We've made sure.
Right. So we have moved. Yeah, so it's been a depressing topic, hasn't it? And it is. But sort of end on a high, would you say, I know it's baby steps, pardon the pun, but do you feel like we are now on a more positive trajectory and there are things that we can all build on?
I think there's things that we can definitely build on. My worry is that, you know, like we said about the staffing, that the system is sort of creaking, yeah. isn't it? In an ideal world, we could, you know, all the things that we can provide, we know what we need to do. The policy's there now. We know absolutely what we need to do. But if you're doing that with a sort of very thin on the ground staff, it's
well,
very
exactly
difficult.
Because even if you have a midwife yeah. with a woman in her cell, you know she's about to go in labour, you think you can get her to hospital, but it might take you 40 minutes to get her from her cell yeah. into the transport yeah. just because you need to get through all these locked doors. Yeah. You know, and yeah. I guess, you know, with the greatest will in the world, prisons are prisons. The architecture is the architecture.
Absolutely.
Just quickly, I want to finish on talking a little bit about when a mother is in a mother and baby unit with her baby and the points of separation.
Yeah.
Because I know there's two different ages, aren't there?
There
depending are. On the length of sentence.
I think so. I mean,
I sort of seem yeah. to remember from my dissertation yeah, 20 I years think, ago, and I don't know if it's changed.
Yeah. Again, I didn't, my focus wasn't on the sort of older baby so much,
okay.
but it was, but I, because I spent time in mother and baby units, it's usually around 18 to 20 months, which, you know, it's an unusual situation to be in the first place, I think, because of those longer sentences. But I have seen it happen where a mother and baby, a toddler, are separated. And you can see with these little toddlers, they are ready to sort of move out of that environment.
Right.
However, it's very, I mean, I just can't imagine what it must feel like to have a baby removed and a toddler removed from your care. Must be just awful.
Totally. And particularly at that age, you know, when yeah. they're small. And I remember with mine, my husband couldn't even take one of the babies off me yeah. without that baby having a complete meltdown because that baby just wanted to be with me. I was the food giver. I was the, you know, you are as the mother. And it just, again, it's sort of doesn't bear thinking about, really, does it?
The prisons do, I think they take a lot of care over this. And I know it's not just a sudden removal in those cases. So it's a really careful, they have, you know, it's a gradual thing over sometimes over months where the baby will go and stay outside with family members. So I don't think it's something that the prisons just do sort of suddenly. So they're quite careful about this because obviously the damage to that baby, it's just, I mean, I can't imagine, you know, again, as a mum, I just cannot imagine that myself. I don't know how these women, you know, that's something that I did feel the women that I met, you know, all the women that I've met in prison, they've been the resilience. I just think a lot of us would just crumble. There's a huge amount of resilience that these women have on board just through their life experiences that they're going through. But and that's something, again, you know, the new research that I'm doing, that I want to focus very much on their women's experiences. Even if we know that the woman is never going to be allowed to have a baby with her, we still need to make sure that there's appropriate care for her. Even if she has committed something really terrible that she can't have a baby, I mean, that's something that's important. So hopefully the new research will have some more recommendations coming out about how we wrap that care around her.
Great. And when's that likely to be published?
That all well, we've just started it, so I think you're going to be speaking to one of the lived experience team about the research. So we've just started, so it literally just started in December. So we're doing this with in conjunction with Birth Companions and also the lived experience team, and you must have a look at the logo that's been designed, because that's been designed by the women.
Amazing.
The project, it's just just blown us all away.
And the name of that research or the title?
Lost Mothers.
Lost Mothers.
Yeah, if you look at lostmothers.org. And again, when we had a workshop recently, I wanted to check with the women that the title reflected how their own experience, and they're very clear that that does reflect how they felt, very sort of lost, out at sea, you know, in between spaces. It was very poignant, actually, how the women really identified with that title, Lost Mothers. So really, I'm going to be interviewing prison staff, health visitors, midwives, social workers. I want to really unpick what's going on, and also looking at the mother and baby boards, looking at the processes. And I've got three amazing research assistants who've just joined us, and they're so I'm sure you'll meet them at some stage. So they're brilliant, and they're very keen to sort of, they've literally just joined us this week, so it's fantastic. So we've got quite a good team working on this.
Brilliant. Well, you'll have to come back and tell us about that research once it's out
there. And hopefully that will make some changes.
Well, thank you so much. It's been fascinating talking to you. It's such a big topic. Of course, it is slightly sort of depressing, but we like to be optimistic.
Yes, definitely.
And of course, if we don't have people like you doing this work, none of the rest of us can sort of get behind you and help. So, you know, it's great, the work that you're doing. And fingers crossed that in a couple of years' time, you'll be able to come back and we'll talk about all the positive things that have happened and the difference we're all making. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
In our next episode, we will be continuing the exploration of pregnancy and birth in the justice system. We'll be delving deeper into some of the data and hearing from a woman who has lived experience of pregnancy in prison and works with Laura on the Lost Mothers project team.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.